Lady Hawk's debut album, Lady Hawk, went to number one this week in 2009. Went platinum in New Zealand, charted at number 16 in the UK and Australia, won 6 New Zealand Music Awards and 2 Australian Awards. Solidifying the synth-filled hook-heavy record as one of New Zealand's great albums of the 2000s, Lady Hawk, a.k.a. Pip Brown, took inspiration from 80s superstar musicians and songwriters like Stevie Nicks, Kim Wilde, Pat Benatar and Cyndi Lauper, crafting a sound very much her own. It is an absolutely fantastic album there. So that album, Lady Hawk, number one this week in 2009. You're on the panel, RNZ National, Dr. Ella Henry and Chester Burrows with me this afternoon. Well, it was one of the most gripping showdowns of Saturday night's election. The Māori Party's Rawiri Waititi and Labour's Tamati Coffey were neck and neck until the end, writes Lee Marama McLaughlin in The Guardian. 500,000 special votes are yet to be counted. The Māori Party is nonetheless excited, returning the important Māori seat of Wairiki back to the Māori Party, and so back to Parliament would be a huge win. And Labour returns with its largest Māori caucus, 15 MPs, but it's shown that it cannot be complacent. With us is Dr. Lara Greaves, who lectures in New Zealand politics and public policy with interests around Mana Māori Motuhake at the University of Auckland. Dr. Greaves, kia ora, welcome.
Kia ora.
How did you read the results on this? I mean, are we seeing, if people have talked about, some sort of re-energising in Māori politics?
Well, it was quite exciting, really, at the time. I was kind of thinking that it would be pretty close. There were sort of free electorates that the Māori TV polls showed that could be close. Tāmaki Makaurau having, I think, about like 6 points or so in the polls on it. And those are the ones we were kind of watching on the night. Generally, though, I think the Māori Party did quite well across all of the electorates, including ones that has sort of quite popular Labour incumbent MPs or where Labour's generally done well in the past, considering just our general view of the election as being that it was a red wash and everyone kind of swung towards Labour. I think that it's going to be really interesting to see how Rawiri goes in Parliament as an MP and being sort of a one-man band of sorts.
Yeah.
And so it'll be, I mean, great for the Māori Party to have that, just have that office there, have that seat there and have that sort of established position from which to sort of kind of maybe have the chance of sort of shaping the media agenda or having that sort of independent voice there.
Right, yes, and I saw a picture of Rawiri outside Parliament in the first day in Wellington today. And Waititi's win so far, will that translate into further momentum perhaps and act as a critical counterpoint in Parliament against Labour?
Potentially. That's yeah. where I'm going to be watching Labour, I think, for this next term to see what they do. I mean, they have been talking about how they have, you know, like a large number of Māori MPs in their Māori caucus, a lot of Māori in the general seats as well. And so now it really looks, and I think people just generally on the left are looking at this as well. It's like, okay, so what is Labour going to do now? And for Māori, it's like, what is Labour going to do now for Māori, now that there's not that sort of handbrake of New Zealand First there?
Right, yeah, and we were talking about this, weren't we, Ella, in terms of Rawiri Waititi and the whānau there, and of course he was very instrumental in one of the people setting up those roadblocks as well, you know, making sure people there felt protected.
Well, Rawiri is a direct descendant of Hawaini Waititi, which many people in Auckland will know is the marae out in West Auckland. So he comes from a long line of great whānau Apanui leaders, and I think he's shown in the last few months, you know, the kinds of leadership qualities that Māori admire and respect. And so I'd like to think that the Labour Party will find some way of having an accord, not just with Rawiri, but those Māori who voted strategically, because the Māori Party, you know, it campaigned for the electorate vote, and you could see in each of those electorates that Māori were giving, in large numbers, their electorate vote to the Māori Party candidate, but they were still giving their party vote to predominantly Labour. So you know, those people have voted strategically and could equally vote strategically and differently at the next election. So I do think it is worth the while of the Labour Party to think about how to maintain a relationship. It does not certainly mean, you know, in cabinet, but I do think that Rawiri will bring a different perspective to the Māori caucus. And I'm kind of excited because it's probably the first time since the 1880s, maybe, that there's been a politician in our New Zealand Parliament with a full-time or core.
Is that right, Lara? I think it is, isn't it?
Yep, I've definitely heard that.
Yeah. There are issues that many feel have been left unaddressed, issues like housing, but also issues like Ihu Mātou. And will the Māori Party, considering how they were formed on the back of the foreshore and the seabed, will they be able to occupy that space of issues and push it along a bit and maybe even push the Prime Minister on those sorts of issues?
I think potentially, I think there's real power in having even that one seat there because, I mean, now the Māori Party will be a little bit more in the scope of sort of the media's agenda and be like, okay, what does the Māori Party think about this? What does Waititi think about this? So that will give potential base for a little bit more attention to those issues. And I think just, again, we've kind of seen it over the decades of, like, in the Māori seat, it's great to have someone to hold Labour to account and to be able to create that competition. And, like, the whole point of democracy is, like, a contest of ideas and being able to sort of hold people to account. So I think that's a really important thing and a really great thing for Māori politics going forward.
Just finally, before you go, we were talking before the headlines with Professor Richard Shaw, Chester Burrows here as well from National, just saying, look, in terms of how National needs to change, that diversity will really be something that they'll need to focus on as part of their maybe refresh. Is that something that will need to be important for them?
Yeah, because basically, like, I mean, I just as people that follow politics, we do get wrapped up in the latest election. But, like, what we're looking at right now is, OK, so say Labour gets another term or two. At some point, there's going to be a national government, shock horror, but, like, in the next couple of terms, there will be a national government. And then that cabinet, whoever's going to, we will be a decision-making table, and they will make decisions on behalf of all New Zealanders. And I think generally all of the research shows that you want that to be some kind of demographic reflection of New Zealanders because people can bring their lived experience to the table and that they can kind of speak for different communities. And what is looking like is further down the track when we do get a national government that they will be perhaps far less diverse than what the current or what the government's about to be. And that will potentially lead to issues, say, 2026 or something along those lines. So that's really what I'm kind of looking, just looking at their list now and who's gotten in their seats. That's really the kind of lens that I'm putting on it, eh? That future-facing lens.
Dr. Lara Greaves, thank you again for your time on the panel.
I was just interested. It's important to remember that Māori is a broad-based party, so it's a big party, and it needs to attract voters from right across the political spectrum. The Labour Party. The Māori Party then is campaigning for a Māori vote. It can say all sorts of things that Labour can't say. And that's that doesn't have to mitigate what it's saying or anything else. Debbie Packer's a neighbour of mine. She's a couple of hundred metres up the road. We talk pretty often. And she came out and said things that a lot of Pākehā wouldn't have liked. But they were real issues for Māori. And she could say them really forcefully and good on her, and I think that lifted. I had predicted that it was going to be a real good go between her and Adrian Rudafi, but then, of course, the red tide changed, really. If there hadn't been a COVID, it would have been really interesting contest, particularly in that seat, because of Debbie and what she was prepared to say. But that's the stark difference between Māori and Labour and Māori and the Māori Party. Māori and Labour are having to mitigate everything in case they scare those horses too much and they lose some of that the Pākehā vote that they need. And the Māori Party can say what they like because they're smaller and they're niche and all power to them. As between the comment that was made in relation to a future national government, remember, John Key brought the Māori Party in when he didn't need the vote. And I think
that's a fair point.
It was a clever strategy. Unfortunately, a whole lot of Māori Party voters didn't like the fact that they went with the National Party in spite of, you know, whānau ora and everything that they were able to achieve. But it is, yeah, it's going to be a really interesting one to watch, and that's really pleased point, to see them back.
I could not agree more, and I do think that what John Key showed was a sensitivity to what you spoke about, Chester, you know, that reaching out into the Māori community. The difficulty, though, was for after three wins, Māori at the flax roots could see little had changed for far too many of them. And so they put that down to the national government and, by association, the close relationship that they had with the Māori Party. So this government is is on notice. You know, it has talked a lot about addressing issues that are really important to Māori: housing, child poverty, crime. And so we, the Māori world, are going to be looking very closely at how they perform. Mm.
Well, it's 17 to 5. The panel are in national. Now, a national hui on the future of New Zealand's food sector has been discussed in Wellington this week. Issues like sustainability, diners' changing needs, and the impact of COVID-19 on eating and cooking habits. There was also talk of a national food strategy being needed, merging the country's Māori Pacifica health, agribusiness, local government and community perspectives into a unified path forward. So we'll discuss that too with the Eat NZ's Chief Executive, Angela Clifford. Kia ora, Angela.
Kia ora.
Let's talk about 2020 January onwards. New Zealand changed in a way that it never had before. How did food habits change here?
Yeah, a huge change, I think. A reset in many ways across many sectors. We had food shortages, we had food waste, increase in food waste, we had hungry people and no way to feed them. For our food producers, they weren't able to process crops in some Right. areas. So yeah, I suppose really what it did was showed the weakness in our current food system and highlighted a lot of that.
It's almost a history unto itself, isn't it? Food under the time of pandemic could be a book or something. And also, too, in that, people were often forced to cook when there was the full lockdown. Recall that. There was no takeaways. So all of a sudden, people were making things at home.
Yeah, absolutely. And how do we feed ourselves? And, New Zealand's got some major health issues around food, and yet we tell the rest of the world that we produce some of the healthiest food in the world. So where's the mismatch there? Why is there a gap?
So there was also a talk of trying to sort of combine various elements into one unified strategy, a national food strategy underpinned by several key principles. What would a national food strategy entail, perhaps?
It would have to entail looking at the connection between food and health. We'd have to consider things like social inequity and food access. We'd have to look at the resilience of our farming and our fishing systems in the face of ongoing climate and global disruption. It would really give us a map or a plan of a way forward as a country. It sort of sets some parameters for policy and sort of big picture thinking around our food system.
Let's go to you, Chess. Do you have a question or a thought?
What I think is missing is a sort of a uniquely New Zealand food or taste. A lot of our restaurants are ethnic restaurants. They don't necessarily reflect Māori or Pacifica, which I would quite like to see. When we think about New Zealand food, we tend to think about sort of Kiwi icons like the mince and cheese pie or the cheese roll from Otago or something like that. And I think that's a real shame. I'd like to see us sort of brand that a lot better. I think New Zealand farming feeds about 45 million people worldwide, and so it's got a huge reputation. But in actual fact, we don't do a whole lot about celebrating that at home. And if you were an overseas visitor coming to New Zealand wanting to eat specifically Kiwi food, you'd probably be given something that comes straight off an English menu or an Asian menu.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot at Eat New Zealand. Like, how do we connect the story that we tell in our international markets with experiences that people can have back here in our own country? What we're seeing is really the emergence and the unearthing of our original food stories, and they do sit around Māori and also Pacifica. And so that's a really exciting time, and we can see some sort of heroes in that space that have spoken over the last 2 days, people like Riri Spragan and Monique Fiso. So we can see a new generation of conversations that are led by original food stories. So, yeah, it's coming, and it's a really exciting time to be involved in New Zealand food.
What are your thoughts, Ella?
I couldn't agree more. I think these are wonderful ideas. I do have a cautionary note, though, and that is that the reality is for many New Zealanders who live in poverty, they don't have the kinds of choices that those of us who have a stable income do. And I think there needs to be a lot more emphasis placed from early childhood onwards around educating in a positive and meaningful way young folk around nutrition and diet and planting food. You know, I live in a suburb where the local primary runs a garden and all the kids learn how to plant, and then they harvest, and then they learn how to make food.
That's
with
cool.
That. So there's this lovely cycle that we've lost in many ways of how food, where it comes from, and how good it is when you grow it and hunt it and, you know, nurture it. And I think we need to do more of that as part of that addressing the poverty issues.
What do you think, Angela?
Yeah, we talked about that as well, and the opportunities that exist around the current school lunch program to sort of create a reset around our communities providing and educating our children in food. And, you know, the predictions, well, the plan is to roll that out to a significant number of New Zealand schools by the end of term one next year. So what would that look like if we created community solutions to school lunches rather than sort of big national providers or service providers? So enabling communities to become more self-sufficient and more resilient and to feed and educate their own children.
Certainly a huge issue, isn't it? One that maybe it's a plan that might be worked on as an overarching, almost like a RMA of food.
Absolutely. The notion of communities, community-based solutions are the most enduring and resilient. You know, bringing elders in who are in their homes and to local schools to teach young folk about the ways that they used to use those food when they were young, you know.
Angela, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it. Very interesting. Eat NZ Chief Executive Angela Clifford. Just one comment for you, Chester. Chester! Exclamation mark. The cheese rolls are from Southland, not Otago.
I stand corrected.
How could you get it so wrong? 10 to 5, the panel is the National Dr. Ella Henry, Chester Burrows, with us this afternoon. Now, we've already had a bit of response on this, actually. Would you change your mind about renting or buying a property if you found it was believed to have been haunted? A story by New Zealand Herald reporter Chris Mariner looks at a Pukekohe home with which residents claim is haunted by ghosts. Three workers from the Philippines claim to have heard footsteps running and women crying, among other troubling experiences. Now, the previous owners said they had experienced a ghostly presence once 20 years ago. With us is Belinda Moffat, the Chief Executive of the Real Estate Authority. Welcome.
Oh, kia ora. How are you? Thanks for having me on the show today.
Yes, great to have you on, Belinda. It's an interesting one. Listen, tell me, are sellers obliged to tell buyers if they believe the house is haunted?
Well, look, in New Zealand, we don't have a haunted house rule per se. But under the real estate professional client care and conduct rules, agents cannot withhold information about a property that should, in fairness, be shared with potential buyers. So what that means is that we look at, or we encourage agents and buyers and sellers to think about sensitive issues. So the types of issues that you might think I ought to know about if I'm about to buy a house. And the category that sort of the things that fall into that category are more like unnatural deaths.
Right.
Suicides or violent crimes. And so in those situations, an agent and the seller would need to assess whether, in all fairness to purchasers, potential purchasers, and the ultimate buyer, there is anything that they should disclose. So there is some guidance on that issue in New Zealand.
Yeah, but other countries, they do have a haunted house clause.
Look, I have to confess, I'm not sure if whether other countries have a clause like that. But I would say that they will have disclosure principles, and they will have disclosure principles that are based on fairness.
I suppose it's only fair to say that because when it comes to buying a house, there's a lot of emotion in it, and aside from being haunted, a spirit of a house or a feeling of a house, that's what a lot of people, I can imagine, look to.
Well, they may well do that. You're absolutely right that buying a house is a massive transaction. It's often, you know, it's the biggest transaction that people will get into, and it's a really personal and emotional transaction. But the principles that guide the sector and particularly the agents is about what information do you have that's probably more that is evidence-based that you feel in fairness to the parties to the transaction should be disclosed. And so that's what they will need to think about. And I guess, you know, that sort of question around if there's a sense about a house, that's probably not enough to meet the test for disclosure. I think that we're looking more at evidence-based factors. So did something happen at the house that perhaps attracted some notoriety in the community? If it did, how long ago did it happen? Have other people lived in the house since that time? If an event that could be attributed to a sense of the house happened at that place, then did it happen inside or did it happen outside? And I think what we'd be saying to agents and to sellers is you need to think about if there's anything that, as I said before, in fairness to the purchaser, you need to disclose.
Very interesting. Chief Executive of the Real Estate Authority, Belinda Moffat, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much.
Bruce says, years ago in London, I stayed overnight in an upstairs room in an old house. It felt weird in the night. The next morning, they told me that the room next door was haunted. Wouldn't stop me buying the place, though. Yeah. Ever seen a ghost, Stella?
I'm Maori. I live with my ancestors perpetually on my shoulders, telling me what to do, slapping me around the neck if I do it wrong. So, you know, they may not be ghosts, but they're scary little monkeys.
What do you reckon about this, Chester?
Well, I mean, it wouldn't put me off buying a property or renting a property, but we've, you know, had every property we've lived in blessed before we've taken it over. And people may or may not think that does anything. Doesn't really matter then, does it? But from our point of view, we wouldn't take over a house without doing that and going through that process in the same way you would, you know, a new construction. We often have elders come through and bless the building. In fact, you'd be lucky to find a government building being opened without that process happening. These days, we do exactly the same thing in the houses that we've taken over.
Well, this is exactly what happened because my father, being a minister, you know, he did exactly the same thing. In fact, there was a little, the first house they bought, blessed, and then a little plaque because he was so proud of the house, you know, blessed by Reverend Chapman, you know. So is it a bit of that, actually, because a wairua to a home, it's very, very... Whether or not you believe in ghosts, it is important, isn't it?
The spirit is a real thing. Whatever your faith, whatever your religiosity, we all know that there's a sense of something about life itself that is the spiritual, wide or whether we use that word, and to pay homage to it, I think, is a healthy way to live in the world.
Very, very good. Well, on a final note, it seems like it's goodbye to Marie Kondo and goodbye to decluttering. Welcome to Cluttercore, or the pandemic trend of celebrating stuff and comfort, where every object sparks joy. Gone is the clinical look, and let's open our arms to a mantelpiece of mementos. Organised clutter on coffee tables and wall paintings sandwiched together. All this from an article by Morwenna Ferrier in The Garden, which she said stems from the Victorian habit of acquisition and display. So, well, who wants to start? I can imagine you would live yourself in a life of wonderful cluttered Chester with all the paintbrushes and I don't know.
Certain rooms of the house. Actually, I was thinking about this because we took over a house a couple of years ago and it doesn't have a mantelpiece and it looks really stark. There's sort of nowhere to put your stuff and so it just seems really unusual. I've been wondering how I can go about constructing one. It's sort of got a freestanding wood burner, so there's no need to have a mantelpiece over a fireplace, and I feel a bit lost with that.
Buy yourself a false fire front.
I might have to do something like that.
And then put
Ella.
A fabulous poster of, I don't know, Marilyn Monroe and where the fire would be.
Well, I've got an Ella at home who may not think that's a fantastic idea, Ella.
That is so relatable to me when we took our fireplace out and the mantelpiece had gone. But where did you put the family photos and that type of thing? What about you, Ella? I mean, a whole movement dedicated to organised clutter. And we're not talking hoarding here. No. Just that maximal style. What do you reckon?
Well, it's really gratifying to know that after 50 years, my home decorating style has come back into fashion.
So you were never a big fan of that minimal style of...
I never got to declutter. But I have had children for the last 35 years wandering around and leaving things in the garage and the spare room and eventually telling me it's an artwork that belongs to me now. So, clutter may well be my middle name.
Yeah, yeah. It's one psychologist, Chester, called clutter a living archive of memory. You know, it's a nice way to describe it, isn't it? We want those mementos around us. We want those pictures of family gone by and that type of thing.
Yeah, I can certainly relate to that. I just can't think of the phrase that people use from the Nordic countries where when people get old, they start sort of decluttering, getting down to sort of minimalist. And I just don't get that. I grew up with grandparents, for instance, who had, you know, a huge rogues gallery all over the dining room wall of
yes.
Who in the Zoo and all the rest of it, prized mementos, and I actually like that sort of stuff.
Wonderful. Catherine says, Wallace, the Garden to Table program currently offers around 15,000 children food education, which Ella alluded to. So we might talk about Garden to Table a little bit later in the week, perhaps.
They do fabulous work. I think they do absolutely wonderful work.
Ella Henry, Chester Burrows, thank you very much for being on the panel this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
Kia ora.
I'm Wallace Chapman, back tomorrow, 3:45. Checkpoint is next.